I'm happy to be here today to talk to you about this tool that we've developed. What I want to do is give you a sense of sort of the conceptual framework we used, a little bit of our thinking and the secondary research we did to identify what would be included in the tool, the piloting process that we did, and then show you a little bit what we've managed to do since the piloting in person is to be able to get it online onto a website to increase accessibility to it. There we go. So starting with the conceptual framework, we developed this trajectory of health disparities, which really recognizes that some people are born into conditions that don't treat them fairly or equitably. And these are things like poverty and racism. And those kinds of root factors play out at community levels, influencing the environments where people live. So that, for example, you have higher rates of alcohol density, less access to affordable food, not as many safe places to play, more toxic elements in the environment, fewer housing or employment opportunities, etc., and that these kinds of environments in the community affect behavior and shape behavior in a fundamental way, and that together those kinds of things result in people disproportionately being sick and injured. And of course, then when they go for medical services, the medical service access to medical services is diminished and the quality of care is much less than some other people are getting, and therefore we have at the end great disparities in health among racial, ethnic, and lower socioeconomic groups. What we really see is this box environmental, particularly environmental and community factors, which it doesn't say that exactly. I'm not that tired right now. But the environmental behavior factors as a key opportunity for prevention to really look at reducing the number of people who get sick and injured in the first place with a goal of closing the health gap. And that's mostly what I'm going to be talking about today, but I kind of want to talk about this framework in a slightly different way. So when people talk about decreasing disparities in health, the first place people tend to talk about going is to reduce disparities in healthcare access and treatment. And that's obviously very, very important, but we also know as long as we don't reduce the reasons people are getting sick and injured in the first place, we're going to have more and more people in need of services that, you know, we have this kind of crumbling healthcare infrastructure that can't address that. So what we did is we took a step back from these reasons people seek medical treatment, heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, injury, and violence, which are among the leading causes of death in this country, and all of them are preventable. And we said, well, what are the things contributing? And we particularly looked at Michael McGinnis and Bill Fagey's work, The Actual Causes of Death, where they looked at death rates in the United States in 1990. And it said things like malignant neoplasm and blunt trauma to the head. And they said, but that's not really why people are dying. The actual causes, and they had nine of them, were things like diet and activity patterns, tobacco, alcohol and drugs, sexual behavior, car crashes, firearms. Seven out of nine of those actually were behaviors. And when I look at those things, I think, okay, those really connote individual behavior, but is it really individual choice? And we took a step back to look at the community environments people were living in where you could see the greatest disparities to really look at how those environments were shaping behaviors in the environments. Typically, when people think about the environment's influence on health, they think about the role of toxins in the environment, the quality of air, water, and soil. You can also think about sort of the direct relationship between environment and health, just the stressors in some environments, the stressors of living in poverty, etc. But the environment also has a fundamental influence on behavior, which in turn shapes health outcomes. So here's an example of a direct effect of the environment on health. Outbreaks of asthma triggered by things in the environment. But here's the kind of stuff we looked at to look at how community environments might affect behavior. And this is from a study that came out in 2002 in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine and compared the resources in low-wealth and high-wealth neighborhoods. And what you can see here is really the difference between, for example, the number of supermarkets in high-wealth versus low-wealth neighborhoods. Kind of equal on carrying out places, but you can see that if you don't have as many supermarkets, then that's probably going to be, the carryouts are going to be more of a place where you might be getting food, and those tend to be kind of junk food, high fat, high salt, high sugar, and of course much higher density of alcohol outlets in low-wealth neighborhoods. The other thing that this study showed was that for every supermarket in an African-American census tract, fruit and vegetable intake went up by 32%. So does the environment affect behavior? The evidence looks like it pretty much does, and that's not surprising because when you can't access healthy, nutritious, and affordable food, you're not going to be able to eat it. When the Institute of Medicine looked at behavior in an environment and how do we change behaviors, they concluded that it's unreasonable to expect that people will change their behavior easily when so many forces in the social, cultural, and physical environment conspire against such change. That means that by focusing on individuals and asking them to change behaviors and working on individual behavior change, we're not going to be very successful, because there's too many things going on that are really affecting people's behavior. And so we really need to look at that social, cultural, and physical environment. So what we did for all of these leading causes of death and then the actual causes of death, we looked at the research in terms of community environments, and we tracked that information and sort of came up with a set of clusters and factors. And the other way I want to talk about how we did this was that we were really looking to identify kind of a community resilience tool. That for the most part, we felt like things are too focused on risk reduction. But even if you remove the fast food restaurant, you know, all the fast food outlets, you know, there still has to be some other source of food in the neighborhood. And that there's been, I think, increasing focus on resilience, which I think is really the ability to thrive in spite of the presence of risk factors. But for the most part, it hasn't focused on community issues. For the most part, the resilience literature is focused on individuals. Things like caring adults, high expectations, opportunities for voice and choice, and that when people have talked about community resilience factors or community assets, for the most part, they've looked at the kinds of things in place that would support those individual characteristics, so that if young kids need caring adults, then the community asset is the number of mentors. And we wanted to say, to kind of look at it more broadly and say, well, there's things that could inherently be in communities that when those things are in place, people will be safer and healthier. And that it's really no mistake that in some communities those things don't exist in the same ways in other communities, because there's really been a history of disenfranchisement and neglect from a long history of institutional and governmental policies. So we identified a set of 13 factors in these three clusters, and I'll go through them somewhat quickly. The first is equitable opportunity. Do people of all races and ethnicities have access and equal opportunities in the community? Are there at least living wage jobs and local ownership? Local ownership of, you know, housing stock, local ownership of businesses, etc. And is there quality education? Here's some pictures of those kinds of equitable opportunity factors. Place. So this is the more the physical place, man-made place, the what people more typically think about as the environment. We included here look, feel, and safety. Is this a place that people perceive being safe? Is it a place that you'd want to be, that you'd want to live in? Are there adequate parks and open space? Can people get to where they need to be? Jobs, childcare, medical services, can they get to, you know, supermarkets, etc. Is there safe, affordable housing? This what's sold and how it's promoted. We looked at sort of you know, I come from Oakland in California, and there kids talk about how they can go down on their street corner and get a gun in 20 minutes, but they have to take two buses to get school supplies. So, you know, what is it that you can access in the community, and is it things that will promote safety and health, or are there things that are putting people at higher risk? And then the quality of air, water, and soil, and the presence of arts and culture. So, a few more pictures. This one on the bottom was actually taken in a market. You know, these corner markets, in order to survive, tend to have pretty high alcohol density. You know, that's kind of how they support themselves. But this one was managed to kind of get a lot of produce in there, and that was what was available for the community. So people, this is has to do with the trust and interconnection between all the people who live in the neighborhood. How well do they get along? Do they trust each other? Do they talk to each other? Are they willing to act for their common good? And what are sort of the accepted behaviors and attitudes and kind of the norms around accepted behaviors? So what we did is we put this into a tool, and we piloted it in three places around the country, rural, urban, and suburban sites. This was our suburban site, which is a suburb outside of Sacramento in California. And we went through a day-long process with folks there. We actually, in that particular place, we did one both with youth and another one with adults. And you know, we presented kind of the research that connected all these things in the community to health and safety outcomes, and then we let them prioritize what their most important factors would be. We did this in each of the sites. The second was Hidalgo County in New Mexico. This was our rural site. The biggest community there had 400 people in it, and there were 6,000 people spread out over hundreds and hundreds of miles. Here they said, Thrive has changed the way we view things. Resilience is the future for us. This has changed how we think about youth and programs for them. And then our last one was in New York City, which was the exact opposite in density to Hidalgo County. There were as many people in the building next to us as there had been in the entire town. And we piloted it with three of the health office bureaus in the city. This is from one of the participants, the youth participants. Thrive makes me believe that I can make a difference in my community. We went back to the communities 4 months later, and we asked them, you know, what if there were any outcomes. And, you know, we weren't, for a one-day event in a community, we weren't really sure we would get any. We were kind of surprised. In one of the sites, they had trained more than 50 young people on this approach as a way to think about their community, and young people were going out and talking to each other about this. Another site launched a teen center in conjunction with the schools, which was really clear that, you know, young people were saying, we need a safe place to meet. Established a countywide mentoring program. Two of the sites initiated farmers markets specifically with, you know, people saying we need access to healthy food in our neighborhoods. And one of them did this as part of their economic development plan. So they were really looking at the intersection of these issues. It enhanced public health and housing partnerships. And one of the communities started looking at health impact in their planning decisions. We brought this back to our expert panel. And kind of assessed what their thinking was about the value of this tool. They said it contributes to a broad vision about community health. It can confirm the value of upstream approaches. It really challenges traditional thinking about health promotion and really giving, such as giving people brochures, and was a good strategic planning tool for community and organizational levels, and really said it takes these really, like, a lot of concepts and puts them into kind of a framework that we can use and understand. You won't be able to read this very well, but we, after we did the pilots, we were able to get some funding to try to sort of replicate the in-person process we did on the website so that it would be accessible for, you know, people who could access communities. This is kind of, you can see the factors there. For each one of those, we talk about what does this mean, how does this relate to health and safety outcomes, We also allow people to enter the tool by identifying and prioritizing what their major health concerns are, because that is often where communities are at. And so in that case, if people do that, we'll highlight the factors that are most closely associated to their health concerns. And then for each one, when people decide, or when a community decides this is something they want to take action on, we give sort of a sample action menu of the kinds of things they might want to look at doing to address that issue in their community. We provide case studies and additional links and resources. And I just want to acknowledge the support that we had to do a lot of this work. The California Endowment supported the research that we did. The Office of Minority Health supported the piloting of the tool. And the Community Technology Foundation of California has enabled us to map it onto a website. And you can get more information about it at our website. Thank you. That's a really good question. You know, one of the things, because there's all these kind of technical terms and what the research says, and we realized we couldn't develop a different tool for every single community. I think there is some work that could be sort of the next steps in kind of getting general tools more applicable in different communities. But the way that we accounted for that in the process was that once communities voted on their highest priority factors, there was a point in there they would identify what their own indicators were, what they wanted to achieve, what was important for them. We didn't set those indicators for them, and we also let them name the factors whatever they wanted. So once they were prioritized, we said, look, this really has to work in your community. What does this mean to you? And in Hidalgo County, New Mexico in particular, they took the issue of norms. They have pretty high teenage alcohol usage rates, and a lot of that is kids are bored, parents are like, here, take this and, you know, take this and go drink it, you know, over there kind of thing. And there's this whole norm around that's just what our kids do. And they took that as one of their big issues, but they changed it into, they called it costumbres. And they really felt like that would really, that for people in the community, that would really reflect what they were trying to get at and the essence they were trying to get at that one. And to really work with parents to kind of find, you know, alternative opportunities for young people. And then at the same time, they're the ones who set up the mentoring programs and the and some of the teen centers. So we let them identify their own indicators, their names, to identify what's working, what's not working, and where they want to go. So we were really providing a framework, and then through the facilitation, tried to help the community identify its own way of prioritizing and addressing those things.